Did you? Okay. So, I wanted to talk about the book business a little bit. You said that you published nine books?
Or, I think it's nine.
And so, these were all topics in mass spectrometry?
Yeah, well, one or two of them were reaction rights, the little books.
But
I think
this is kind of like esoteric chemistry. The reaction rate theory stuff, right? I mean, it's not physics.
No.
So you must have picked up a lot more chemistry than you got from that course that ICI taught you for.
I think I picked it up talking to chemists and living in a chemistry environment.
So you really essentially end up being a chemist for all practical purposes.
Yeah.
Let's see. There was this other issue that I wanted to touch base on, which is escaping me right now at this particular point in time, but I'll come to it. So you had this long-term interest in nomenclature that you were involved with the IUPAC on nomenclature discussions or establishing the nomenclature for mass spec.
Yeah, I was on an ASMS committee for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on an IUPAC committee.
And did that result in anything?
No, nothing really
came of it.
Noteworthy.
It was just an attempt to try and standardize the literature.
To try to get people to be completely logical, and but people never are.
Yes, well, there's a. I meant to bring in with me. This is something that a fellow by the name of David Sparkman has published. They call the Mass Spec Desk Reference, and it has a. It's just a book devoted to the appropriate way to refer to things mass spec wise. But I forgot to bring it with me. I think you would have enjoyed seeing that. I think your interest in that area was fruitful in the long run. By this book really covers quite a bit of those details that you were dealing with back at that point in time. So when we left off before lunch, you had started at Swansea University here, and you were continuing. You'd established yourself with a group, and you started working. What were the initial topics that you did research on at that time?
Well, we were starting with the ZAP. I had, as I say, three students. One was Christopher Proctor. One was Stuart Howells.
There was Gareth.
Well, Gareth was a postdoc.
And Janet?
Janet Harris.
Harris. Was a student. So you had three students and a postdoc. How do you spell Howells?
H-O-W-E-L-L-S.
E-L-L-S, Howells. And what topics did you guys get started on?
Well, they were all on the ZAB and Mike's topics. And what's become of them now is that Chris Proctor is, I think he's the managing director of the British American Tobacco Company.
No way, okay.
Stuart Howells is making lasers somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And Janet Harris is a housewife.
Mm-hmm.
Got a family. And
yeah, but Gareth is still involved.
Gareth is still in the university, yeah.
Okay. And this was...
There was also F.M. Harris, Frank Harris. He came to work with me. He had the idea of exciting ions by shining a laser on them.
Mm.
We did a lot of work on that. That was very fruitful.
So how did you created the ions and then did the laser exposure?
Yeah.
So how did you? You got to get the ions to sit still for the laser.
Well, we drilled holes in the flight tube.
Mm-hmm.
So we could shine the laser light either down, either along the iron beam or... Hello? Hello? Nobody there. Hello?
They'll probably call back. So you did a modification of the instrument in order to get the laser beam into the instrument for...
Yeah, we had a dye laser. A very powerful one. I put in a request for funds.
Mm.
I was told by the Science Research Council that it wouldn't work, that the laser wasn't powerful enough.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I reckoned it was. They said it wasn't, so I said, all right then, I resubmit the thing but for a laser 10 times as powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, in that case, you'll be able to excite H2+, but nothing else.
Mm.
Well, they were completely wrong, and our original calculations were right. We had a laser that was plenty, plenty strong enough to excite the ions.
Hmm. So somebody was doing a miscalculation on their end. And what was the outcome of doing this laser excitation of the ions? Was bringing you to do...
Well, there were various things. One thing I can remember was looking at toluene.
Mm-hmm.
Has a spectrum that starts off with a 92 plus molecular ion and a 91 plus ion.
Mm-hmm.
And to see how the ratio of 92 to 91 altered as a function of excitation of the beam.
So the 92 would be the molecular ion and the 91 would be the terpillium ion. Yeah. So as you change the laser energy, the relative amounts of these.
And then you could see from the metastables how these two fragmented and how the energy in them affected the fragmentation.
Mm. And so this was the idea that Harris had to use the laser.
Yeah.
Okay, and was that the extent of it?
It was an argon ion laser.
Argon ion?
I think it was 18 watts, the final one that we got.
Mm-hmm.
It was strong enough that, you know, if you walk past, you had to be careful because your clothes would start burning.
Uh-oh. Well, of course, if it's focused down to a narrow beam, and which it is, a laser, it can be, 18 watts can be dangerous. And so how long did you stay at Swansea?
For 12 years.
Okay, so that would have been 86.
I retired in 86.
Okay.
For the second time.
Second time, yes. And by that time, you had a fairly large group, I would imagine.
Well, not all that large, but I think in one of these publications it shows it.
Mm, okay.
Let me see if it's in this one. Some sort of size group I had.
Oh, okay.
But I used to have people from all over the world. Let me see that particular one and I'll tell you where they're all from.
Well, that's a pretty good sized group. Did you have more than one postdoc or?
Well, I had Gareth Brenton and Frank Harris, who were both brought up to professorial status ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Can't really see very well. Well, that's Frank Harris. And there's an electronics technician. And he was seconded to me from British Petroleum. There's my secretary, me. He's from Israel. He's from Australia. He was English. That's another of my students. There's Chris Proctor. as Imag. He was from Venezuela. He was from Iowa. He was from Iran. I used to have an Iranian and an Iraqi while the war was on.
Oh my.
They were the best of friends.
Yes. Crazy. And who are these gentlemen, people up here? They look like a couple of...
I see they're all marked here.
Ah, yes.
She was from Purdue. Mm-hmm. Joyce Weeper.
So it was a fairly decent size operation. We were able to fund all these people out of your Royal Society money, or
and I had a grant from the Science Research Council.
Okay, and it also provided funds for purchasing equipment.
Well, except that I always found that it was far, far easier to get funds for doing the fairly mundane things.
Hmm.
And if you proposed anything that was a little bit sort of out of the ordinary, then they were very conservative and opposed it very strongly. And
So you learned to propose things that weren't too far out in left field. Yeah. But could you then do some left field stuff anyway?
But once you'd got it, I found when I was at Purdue, I used to have to spend a lot more time writing reports for NSF and so on.
Mm-hmm.
On the progress of research and proving that you weren't deviating at all from what you said you were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
In this country, they were much more free and easy. Once you got the money, what they wanted was to see some results and not to have you spending too much time writing reports about it, but getting on with the work.
Mm-hmm. So you got a chance to experience the grant bureaucracy on both sides of the Atlantic.
The very last thing, I should say incidentally, that for publication, you know, you don't generally publish a lot when you're in industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent most of my life in industry, except for my year at Purdue, plus the odd bits, and 12 years at Swansea. So my publishing time was really 13 or 14 years.
Mm-hmm. But you did publish a few things in...
Published, I think, 350 or so.
Yeah. But at ICI, you published
I
some?
I published some, yes. I published 30 or 40, I think.
The motivation for these other books was just because you felt that the book was needed?
Well, I did a book on accurate masses for choosing formulae.
Mm-hmm.
A book on metastables. Because I felt that they needed writing up. The last thing that was done in Swansea was to make a mass spectrometer, to make a spectrometer where the mass resolution was zero.
Yes.
But to get very, very high energy resolution. So the idea was that you take an ion, collide it with something, say collide it with helium, so that you would have an inelastic collision.
Mm-hmm.
And the helium wouldn't get excited because its first excited state is 20 odd volts up in the air.
Okay.
But the iron itself would become excited. And you could, with high energy resolution, you could pick out the individual excitation states.
Mm.
So you could pick out the electronic state and the vibrational levels on it.
Hmm.
So to this we called our energy spectrometer.
Hmm. And you designed and built that instrument?
That was built here, down in Swansea.
Okay.
It consisted of a magnet, small magnet for getting mass separation.
Sure.
Choose your iron.
Mm-hmm.
And then two very large electric sectors with a collision region in between. And when I say very large, I think they were about 30-inch radius.
Mm.
They were huge.
Yeah. What did the machine shop say when you came in with that?
Well, the sectors have to be made in a shipyard somewhere.
Oh. Hm. Yeah. So
I didn't have much chance to work on that. That was about a year before I retired.
I see.
Gareth will tell you about that. He did a lot of work on that.
Okay. Did you patent anything?
Sorry?
Yeah, did you have any patents?
No.
Okay. So you didn't have to deal with a patent office or any of that kind of thing. I guess ICI patented things, but they didn't figure anything you were doing was patentable.
Yeah.
And so when you left there, they still had a fairly benign attitude towards basic research?
Indeed, yes.
Okay. I just wonder if that attitude still exists today. It seems like so many of these companies have moved over to the money is all that counts position. That now this whole thing with accurate mass, when did you get the inspiration, or how did that come about that knowing the accurate mass would provide you the elemental composition?
Well, that was very early. As I was saying, we got the resolution of our first instrument up to about 600 or 700, so we could separate CH4 and O.
Mm-hmm.
And that showed us that if we measured the mass, we could get the formula. And then it's a question of how accurately could we measure the accelerating voltage as we swung from mass to mass.
Mm-hmm.
And we could do it on the single focusing machine to about 20 parts per million, on the double focusing machine to about 1 part per million.
Mm-hmm. And that whole idea of the elemental composition of accurate mass derived from your work, it wasn't something that anyone else...
I don't think so. I think we started it.
Okay. As an application in organic chemistry.
Yeah.
Now, I interviewed Al Neer a long time ago. He said that, that when he was giving a paper or talking about this issue... At one time or another, you intuited the application in organic chemistry of having the accurate mass, because that was obviously one of the things he was interested in doing for the physics side of the business, because they needed to know the exact mass of it.
I remember going to Neer's lab and suggesting doublets that he could use for getting his... I can't remember which ones they were now.
So when did you... visit his lab, do you recall?
I can't remember exactly when.
But you did spend some time in Minnesota.
Well, I visited only a day or two.
Okay.
But I one of the things you see in my CV is that I was a 3M Boomer Memorial Fellow in the 1950s. And I spent, I think it was 3 months in Minneapolis.
At 3M?
At the university.
Okay.
And I got to know Al Neer pretty well.
So you spent some time with him, but essentially you spent a couple of days visiting with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and his lab and seeing what all he was doing.
Alfred Otto Karl.
Yes. Yes, yes. Yes. So that would have been in, do you recall the time, 70, 50, 40s, late 40s, early 50s?
65 was when I was in.
Yeah. So that was a pretty useful experience to have visited Neer. What was your attitude of his contribution to mass spec?
Well, he's got the gift of being able to do things right the first time. But his work and mine never really overlapped, because he was on atomic mass measurement.
Sure.
I think in my book in 1960, there was some unease about the oxygen standard of mass, that oxygen 16 should be 16.
Right.
And they were going to change. IUPAC and everybody were discussing it.
Mm-hmm.
And in my book, I state what I believe should be the standard of mass, that fluorine should be 19.
Hmm.
Because fluorine combines with more elements than any other suggested standard. It's monoisotopic, but they didn't do that, they chose carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think carbon is not a very good choice, because it really combines so readily with hydrogen and gives a very big mass increase, so that the doublets you're measuring are very wide doublets, and mass discrimination and so on comes in, so you don't get a very accurate measure.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it says in my book that fluorine should be the one, and everybody ignored that and chose carbon.
Mm.
And so it is.
Yes. I think, but either one is better than oxygen, do you think? I mean, oxygen had some issues with regard to, of course, carbon has an isotope too, but oxygen, I think, was having some other difficulties. But
it didn't combine with, it wasn't so flexible organic chemically, I don't think.
Right. Now, there's a number of developments that occurred that seemed that maybe I didn't see much in your literature references that were reflected. For instance, Fab, did you do much Fab work?
No.
So Fab was something that really had no interest for you.
It, when it happened, on the doorstep with Mickey Barber, the sources I worked with were electron bombardment and a photo source, a gas discharge, so photo ionization.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of advantages of that.
So, when the Fab hit the world and took off, it wasn't something that really got you were particularly interested in that, applying it for the problems you were working on.
No.
Okay. And neither, I guess, Maldi really.
No, well, that was
it was a later.
The world had got beyond me then, and was going up to high molecular weights, and I think I would have developed some of the things there quite differently than what I would have developed.
I see.
Just because of my particular interests.
I mean, can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, nobody seems. You know, you've got isotopes, and the isotopes are very, very important as an analytical for distinguishing things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you get up to masses of thousands and tens of thousands, then the molecular ion, or the one with all the only carbon 12 in, becomes an insignificant one.
Mm-hmm.
But the isotope pattern is still extremely important in telling what you've got there. And nobody now seems to bother with the isotopic pattern. They're all concerned with the speed with which they can get through the spectrum.
Yes.
And the group of molecular ions is just a spike.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I would do a lot more analysis of the detail of some of these peaks.
I see. The isotopic pattern in the molecular ion. Well, it does get very complex quite quickly.
Yeah, but you've got mathematical aids to help you.
So, do you have any
patterns? I first worked on them when I wrote this book in the 60s. Specifically working on the patterns of the halogens.
Mm-hmm.
Things with 2, 3, 4, 5 and so on, chlorines, bromines in. That became very popular as a way of sorting out the halogen content of compounds.
Right.
Klaus Biemann repeated my patterns in his book. I think found them useful.
Yeah, I think, well, they show up in McLafferty's interpretation of mass spectra book too, so.
Yeah.
So you're saying that you were the originator for those.
Well, anyway, the time of publication and so on is all a matter of record, but I don't want to squabble about
mm-hmm.
who was the first, it's a combination of if you're around at the time, you're bound to be involved. You're bound to have an influence.
That's true. Okay.
And my book, I said it's a good time to write it because it could cover all of mass spectrometry as it developed up until then.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to put in the references, and Elsevier, who published it, insisted on doing this in a very particular way. All the authors, I think, were listed alphabetically. The number of the reference, you looked up Abramovich, say, reference number 76, it would tell you where it was published, and then it would tell you in brackets on which page of the book that reference was mentioned.
Hmm.
I don't think that's done very often, but it's very useful, you know, if you wanted to know something about Near's work, you see.
Mm-hmm.
You just look up Near in the alphabetical list of references, and you could take down all the pages on which various references to Near's work were made.
Hmm. That was the publisher wanted that for the...
Then it had a mass table in it. It was the first time that the mass spectrum of I forget what, heptacosa, tributylamine was the standard. Its mass spectrum was in, and accurate masses of formulae up to mass 500, I think, were given as an appendix.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these were worked out on a hand calculator. Just turning mechanically this hand calculator and reading off and writing down the...
Now, did you do that, or...?
Yes, I did.
Oh, you did all that calculation. You didn't hire someone to do that calculation.
No.
Oh, my goodness.
I did it at home, and Yvonne checked it with me.
Oh, my. That was quite an effort.
Yeah, it was a hell of a job.
Now, you were telling me at lunch that you had some help with the figures and for the book.
Yeah.
What was that about?
Well, Yvonne did all the diagrams for me.
So that was a significant contribution for which she wanted to get paid, right?
Yeah. There is a copy of the book here somewhere.
I imagine there must be.
But I don't know where it could be. Do you know, Yvonne? Do you know where a copy of my book on mass spectrometry
is? No, I haven't seen it.
It's here. I saw it a few weeks ago.
That was certainly a very famous book.
And ASMS then reprinted it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how many of them were actually sold?
Well, I think there was the first printing. They print about 2,500, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think they used to calculate that each library would buy one, and that there were about 600 libraries that buy these.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the first printing sold out. So they said they wanted a revised second edition.
Mm-hmm.
I said there was no way I was going to go through writing again. They could reprint it, but I wasn't going to revise it.
Mm-hmm.
So they reprinted it, and the reprint sold out.
Was that the same run, 2,500, or did they...
I don't know how many it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then they reprinted again, and that sold out, and I think they sold somewhere between 7,000 and 10,000 altogether.
Mm. From which you did derive income, right?
I derived an income, which, considering the time I'd spent on it, repaid me at approximately 10 cents an hour.
You did the calculation.
Yeah, I did.
But think of all the notoriety you got.
Yeah.
It was, well, I mean, it really, your name became synonymous with mass spectrometry after that book and all the various printings of it. So.
The only other money that I made was I had a deal with VG when the ZAB came out. They were talking to their directors, And they said that the trouble with me was that I kept designing big, complicated machines. And I can remember him saying, what I want is a reliable little Toyota. So they said, so how are we going to pay you for this as a consultant? So I said, don't take me as a consultant. Pay me a royalty on sales.
Mm.
So for a few years, I got a royalty on every Zab that was sold.
Mm.
And that was pretty lucrative.
Do you have any idea how many they sold?
Well, I know for quite a while, 30% of their total production was Zabs.
Mm. So basically, ideas that you originated with instrument companies started the MS-9 and the Zab.
Yes, I think.
Both of which were very successful instruments for the companies that built them. And so you put the ideas into them and probably didn't get as much out of them from a financial reward.
For a long, long time, most mass spectroscopists were working on quantitative analysis of mixtures.
Mm-hmm.
And very few were working on qualitative identification. And McLafferty was one of the very few.
Mm-hmm.
I visited all these people in the States. I visited McLafferty when he was with Dow at Midland in Michigan.
Do you recall when that was?
That was when I went to my first ASMS meeting.
Early?
Well, the ASTM committee, E40,
right.
It was. It was the San Francisco meeting. The early 50s, I think.
So then after, you just stopped at Friends Lake.
I used to allow me to go,
mm-hmm.
Not every year, but every other year.
And they, Dow, they were okay with you visiting a guy that worked for Dow?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. And that was when he was at Midland?
Yeah.
Yeah, because he did move to the East Coast eventually.
He did. He went to
the search group.
Birmingham.
Yeah. Okay, so what do you consider to be your most significant publications other than the books?
Well, I think that publication that for helium-2 double plus, I don't know what journal that was in.
Okay, I think I can probably find that in the publication list.
Chemical Communication or something like that.
So this is a fairly esoteric exercise. What prompted this, looking at helium-2 double plus? Is that just to prove that it could be, that the theory could be, could be actually
something a little bit closer to physics than chemistry?
Yeah. There it is, He2 double plus. J. Kim Society Chemical Communications 85 with Gilhouse, Brenton, Bynum, Rabinovich, and Rig Schleyer. It's okay. Let's see if I can get a copy of that. So this is probably the most, esoteric piece of work that you've probably done, or most anybody's done, I would think.
There was another one with things like this. The structure of doubly charged ions,
uh-huh.
Like the structure of doubly charged benzene.
Yes.
Which I believe to be a linear species with the formula CH3 C plus double bond C double bond C double bond C plus CH3.
Okay. So a triolefin and opening up the ring. And to what evidence did you have to support that?
It's fragmentation and the energy that's released when the two charges separate,
mm-hmm.
with Coulombic repulsion, and it shows that they're about 4 angstroms apart, whereas the diameter of the benzene ring is only about 2 angstroms.
Hmm.
So the ring's been opened.
Okay.
Also, that the only way that iron fragments is loss of CH3, always loses 3 hydrogens, whatever it breaks. CH3, C2H3, C3H3.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Which I think is evidence of the CH3 on the end.
And the essentially double.
And four carbons, each of
double bonds, a series kind of like that.
So I did a lot of doubly charged ions fragmenting after that.
From a basic chemist ion, gas phase ion chemistry kind of a experiment. Yeah, I think that's one of Gross's special interests, is gas phase ion chemistry. All right, so you had some topics that you had highlighted on my list that you wanted to discuss in more detail.
Well, I think we've covered them.
Okay. And let me check. I did write down some notes from... So there's this big discussion that is in... the desk reference about accurate mass and exact mass and precise mass and all the subtlety of trying to determine, say there, what you mean with when you do make a mass measurement that has a sufficient accuracy or a number of significant figures in it that you can use it to do an elemental composition. So what do you think is the appropriate nomenclature for that type of a measurement? What do you call it? Do you call it an accurate mass measurement, a precise mass measurement?
I call it accurate mass measurement.
Accurate mass measurement. Okay. I think that's the sense in which the desk reference tries to...
Yeah.
But it's people are not always as careful with these things as they should be in publications, and I think it does can lead to confusion. So, and you elected not to stay at Purdue because the thing showed up here with the Royal Society... If that hadn't showed up, would you have gone and stayed?
I'd still have been in Purdue, I think.
You still would have been there if that hadn't showed up.
But I couldn't. The Royal Society wouldn't allow me to have any other post whilst holding that chair.
Uh-huh.
It was a sort of all or nothing.
Well, that was a pretty nice...
Excuse me.
Yeah, turn this guy off for now.